Morning, everybody. Happy day to all of you. Braden, thank you for doing such a good job leading songs at LTC that you got asked to lead the song at the big gathering at the end. We're proud of you, proud of all of you, and I want to join in thanking everyone who's involved in the whole project, and thank you to every family who participated. And to everybody involved in helping to support that task. We have families who've also been in the process of dealing with their own losses and challenges, and we ask everybody to pay careful attention to the announcements and to remember families in your prayers. And speaking of families, my hearty welcome to the Strongs, the Pecks, and the Davises. We're thankful for the fellowship of each one of you. I'd like to try to tell you this morning a story, which is one of the big reasons I have wanted to be a Christian and have remained a Christian for a long time now. It is a story which illustrates very well, I think, why imperfect human beings like me and like you, we all are, can still rejoice in hope because of what God has done through His Son. It involves a man, a very important character in the New Testament because of the place he plays in the ministry of Jesus and subsequently in the life of the church. We know him as Simon, as Peter, as Cephas, or as some combination of those three names. He's the first in the list, first name in the list of the apostles. When we read about them, he's the one who confesses, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," or at least who gives voice to that confession for the group first off. And he's the one who ends up with the privilege of preaching the gospel of Jesus, the good news of Jesus for the very first time, and to say that the promise is to you and to your children and to all those who are far off. All of those reasons make Peter a very lovable and important character to us. But he's also lovable because he's like us in a lot of ways. The story that I'm thinking of with him started, really unfolds in Luke chapter 22, for example, as the events involving those significant facts of the gospel of the work of Jesus, they're unfolding here. And Peter is involved in the conversation with Jesus, first off, that shows his intention, his good intention, his thoughts about what he was ready for. It's after supper that night when Jesus was going to be arrested. Judas had already gone. Jesus had talked to the others of the disciples in a lengthy way. And one of the things that he's made clear to them is that the shepherd is going to be smitten and they're going to scatter. And that Satan has desired to have them as a group and to sift them like wheat. And Peter says, Luke 22, verse 33, "Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death." And the other writers tell us that he gave emphasis to that. And he said, "Even if I must die with you, I'll not deny you." And he went further, "Even if everybody else forsakes you, all these others do, I won't ever do that." You got to read that knowing that Peter, as a human being, was confident enough in himself and his own convictions that he thought, there's no way I would ever do anything but that. We move along in the story that night, and you kind of can remember how things develop. They're out there in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Jesus is praying in agony, troubled in spirit. He asks them to watch with him, and he comes back, and how does he find all of them? asleep. That's right. And Peter also. And one of the revealing things in Mark's account of this, Mark 14, verse 37, he says, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch with me 1 hour?" We begin to be alerted to the fact that a human being can grow weary and his best intention can end up being a little beyond him. And you go along, and then the prayers of Jesus are finished in the garden, and then here comes Judas with the mob with their swords and clubs and their torches and so on. And Jesus goes out to meet them. And remember to say, "If you're seeking me, let these others go." And if you'll remember, John especially shows us this, that Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his ear. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword in its sheath." Now Peter is on ground that he does not expect. He's doing what he thought he should do to stay with that, "I'm ready to go to prison and to die with you," provided, of course, that we're in the fight. Provided that we're taking them on. Provided that you'll let me do it with my strength and my power and my equipment. Jesus told him to put that away. This wasn't that kind of fight or that kind of kingdom that was at stake. And then remember, they lead Jesus away to the house of Caiaphas and then Annas, the high priestly family, and Peter follows. He does follow at a distance. He ends up sitting with the crowd out there around the fire, the unfriendly crowd. And then the statements get to be made. And Peter is thinking survival at this moment, and he doesn't realize what the impact of this is going to be. The woman says, you were with them. And he says, "Woman, I don't know him." That's verse 57 of Luke 22. And then in verse 58, you were with him. You're one of them. "Man, I am not," he says. And then at verse 60, "You were one of them? You were with them? Man, I don't know what you're talking about." And immediately, you remember, the cock crows. And the Lord turns while Peter is still speaking. Those words are still in his mouth. The rooster crows. The Lord turns to him. And that brings the scene to this, Luke 22, 61 and 62. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered. And he went out and he wept bitterly. Now look at that situation from a human perspective. His intention to go to prison and to die with Jesus perished with weariness and with the hours and with the setting. His idea that even if everybody else never forsake Jesus, he surely never would. Then that ends up kind of fading as the time goes along and the circumstances are changing. And they sneak up on Peter and he doesn't even realize that he's denied the Lord until it has. And then he feels like he's defiled in some way. He feels like he is corrupted. He's a failure. He goes out. He's out alone. And he's devastated in his grief at what he has done. He goes out and weeps bitterly. What if the story ended there? Some of us would be able to identify with Peter in some of those ways or some of those feelings. What if it ended there? But thank God it doesn't. The same fellow we don't read about again in chapter 23 as Jesus is offering himself up for us. But in chapter 24, when the women have gone out to the tomb and they have heard that announcement that Josh read earlier, and they go back and it says in Luke 24, verse 10, It was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women who went with them who told these things to the apostles. At verse 11 it says, "But these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them." That tells you they weren't expecting this. In verse 12 it says, "But Peter rose and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in, and he saw the linen cloths by themselves, and he went home marveling at what had happened." Not necessarily believing there's been a resurrection, not knowing what to make of it, astonished at it. John lets us in on the fact in his record that Peter came to the tomb and he went in and he saw the linen cloths laying there and then the face cloth folded up. And the folded up means it's like puffed up, like there's been something in it and it's just gone, what was in it has just gone through the cloth and through the face cloth, and it's like all of that's like a cocoon that whatever was in it is not there anymore. It just passed through it. And Peter saw all of that, and he walks away marveling, not knowing what to make of it. And if that were the end of the story, that would be some story, but it's not. It's not the end of it. In Luke 24, it goes ahead to tell us about the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they're talking about what we had hoped. We had hoped this is the one who would redeem Israel. Jesus finally makes himself known to them, and in their excitement and joy, they immediately, without any time, make that journey all the way back to Jerusalem, and they find the 11 and those who are with them gathered together, and they say, "The Lord," but the 11 speak to these two guys before these two guys have a chance to deliver their news. The 11 say, "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." Now, we don't have any description of what took place, but Jesus, who last saw Simon when their eyes met and Simon Peter went out and wept bitterly, having denied Jesus, Jesus had sought him out, appeared to him, and it's had a huge impact on Peter. No more just marveling or being bewildered or anything like that. Now then, Peter, from this point on, when we read about him, is going to be a different guy. And this appearance to Peter becomes so important that when the gospel is spoken, it is spoken of almost with this appearance being the end, the last fact in the gospel. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3, through 5. Paul says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that He was buried, and that He was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that He appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. All one sentence there. He appeared to Peter, the man who had not been able to live up to his highest intentions. I noticed in Timothy Keller's little book, The Reason for God, it's a Christian evidence book, and he surveys in one of the chapters the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, surveying the world views of people at the time, what they expected, either Gentiles or Jews, evidence of the empty tomb, evidence from the appearances that the Lord made to people. And then Keller comes to a conclusion, and I'd like to share a paragraph with you. Think about this. He says, I sympathize with the person who says, so what if I can't think of an alternative explanation? The resurrection just couldn't happen. Let's not forget that first century people felt exactly the same way. They found the resurrection just as inconceivable as you do. The only way anyone embraced the resurrection back then was by letting the evidence challenge their worldview, their view of what was possible. They had just as much trouble with the claims of the resurrection as you. Yet the evidence, both of the eyewitness accounts and as of the changed lives, was overwhelming. Peter is one of the eyewitnesses and one of the lives that was changed most in this way. Now, do you know how sometimes if you in your reading or just in conversation, just listening to people, they can say things that will be important to you, will be interesting to you, will have meaning to you. But then if you know something about the background of that person, what that person has been through, or what has happened in that person's life, then what they have said takes on a whole new level of meaning. To think about what Drake said to us last week, he encouraged us to see them when people walk through our door. Let me encourage you to also do that when you read the Bible. See the people there, see what's happening. Now think about Peter. Here he was, having been devastated by the things, the intentions, the confidence, the actions that perished and that faded and left him feeling corrupted, defiled. And then here he is, begotten again to a new hope and a new level of faith by having had Jesus appear to him and having seen him. So now think about what Peter writes to the rest of us. Look over at 1 Peter chapter 1. You will have read this many a time. It's very meaningful. But if you think of it against the background that we've just described, I think the power of it will be helpful to you. Peter says, verse 3 of chapter 1, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to His great mercy, He has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is, look at his words, imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. Look at his words. Imperishable, undefiled, unfading. One commentator said, the things God has in store for his children are so wonderful that they are so far beyond human language that Peter can only describe them in terms of what they're not. They're not perishable. They are not defiled. They are not fading. They can never perish or spoil or fade away. They're untouched by mortality, they're unstained by evil, and they're unimpaired by time. Think of what each of those terms might have meant to Peter in his life. Imperishable. Not like his great intention to die with Jesus if necessary. Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist, has a book, A Confession. And in it he says, my question, that which at the age of 50 brought me to the verge of suicide, was the simplest of questions lying in the soul of every man, a question without an answer to which one cannot live. It was, what will come of what I am doing today or tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? It can also be expressed thus. Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? What's your answer to that question, and why? Peter is telling us here it's because of the resurrection. It's because of the resurrection. It's because of that what we do in our bodies matters and will have meaning, and because of what Jesus has done for us, it's worth it. Peter also says this inheritance is undefiled. That means it's not spoiled, it's clean. I tried to think of a way to illustrate this. The only thing I could think of is I took a notion the other day for the first time in like ever to clean up my old car. And that included, by the way, vacuuming it out. I know Kay will be impressed when her vacuum won't start when she sees it. Grass and Bermuda and pieces of leaves and stems and sticks and all of that had accumulated in there ever since I bought the thing. And to understand what I'm about to tell you, the interior of my car is all black. So you could see the dust and stuff too. So vacuum it out, wipe that dust and stuff. Decided even to clean the inside of the windshield. Got to doing that, and there's an old sticker over here. It was an old inspection sticker. The law got changed after that, and it hadn't been replaced, and it crinkled all up and all of that. It's curling off. So I decided to take a hold of that thing. I had the door open, and it was windy. And little bitty white specks flew all over that car, inside of that car. Man. And then I decided, well, I got to clean that up. So I went and got a cloth and started to do that. And everywhere I wiped over it, a white streak formed. That's a little bit what life gets. You say a word, and the consequences of it spread like that. You do a deed, you have a broken relationship, and you feel like everything is now ruined. There's no hope of it ever being any better or any different. Now, I did finally get that cleaned up, by the way. The Lord has done that with Peter's life too, and with our life as well. And then, unfading. This word is causing to mind, of course, the picture of flowers that are so beautiful only temporarily, and then they fade away. A Christian's inheritance is not like that, thankfully. It does not fade away. And there are two reasons for an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading. The first one is the resurrection. The Lord begat us to this hope, He says, or has begotten us, caused us to be born again to a living hope. It's a living hope because it's hope based in the living one. It's hope that is founded on the fact that He lives. It's a living hope because it's the hope of life. It's a living hope because it makes life better while we're going along. I read the story, maybe a lot of you have too, of Johnny Erickson. I think it's Johnny. Some people will say Joni, I've noticed. Erickson Tada. She was severely injured in an accident when she was 17 years old and suffered paralysis from her shoulders down. She wrote about it a lot, over 40 books later on about different topics, but In those first 2 years, she wrote about how the depression settled on her. She tried to adjust to her new life circumstance because she realized the permanency of it. It started to sink in, and then there was despair and hopelessness, and in her words, no hope of ever walking again, no hope of ever using my hands again, no hope of enjoying all the things that she had looked forward to from a young girl on. And then she started trying to reshape and reorient her thinking based on what the Bible says that the Lord has done for us. And she wrote, "One thing that really helped me in the middle of my hopelessness and depression was to know that at least one day I would have a body that worked, hands that would hug, and feet that would run. Not an angel costume, but a glorified body, much like the kind of body Jesus had after the resurrection." I think that's what the New Testament teaches. At the end of Philippians chapter 3, there are two precious verses, verses 20 and 21. Read them on your own time. 1 John 3, verses 1 and 2 is another passage that says we will see Him and we shall as He is and we'll be like Him. Don't forget that the resurrection of Jesus is the basis of our hope. And the other thing is what God is doing for us. It was God who raised up His Son. It was God. It is God who is now guarding the inheritance that's laid up for us to be ready to be revealed and guarding us through faith. Peter says that in chapter 1 and verse 5. And in chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, he comes to the end of this line of thought. He says about Christ, He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in the last times for the sake of you, who through Him are believers in God, who raised Him from the dead and gave Him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. And that's the phrase I want to stick in our minds. The American Standard Version maybe more accurately translates this, so that your faith and hope might be in God. That's why God has done everything He's done. He doesn't want us, like Peter, depending on our good intentions and the power of our sword. He wants our faith and hope to be in Him, because He knows He can live up to it and will. Let your faith and hope be in God this week. And if we can help you to make that so on the first day of the week, and if we can be help to you in doing what this says here, if you'll let us know that while we stand and sing, we'll be glad to do what we can, okay?